Call Senate Finance Committee back to order for our afternoon session. We have several pieces of legislation before us, and my co-chairman will go over them. The only one that I'm going to be chairing is the supplemental appropriation. Today, we have my co-chairman, Senator Stedman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Egan, Senator Thomas, and Senator Huggins. We have before us the supplemental appropriation bill, HB 326. There have been no changes to the version. It's the same version that came over from the other body. We've already had our public hearing on the legislation. And with that, are there any questions on the supplemental that we previously heard? Seeing none, Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, I'll go ahead and move we adopt the move out the supplemental.
House Bill 326.
House Bill 326.
Are there objections to the motion? Hearing none, so ordered. We'll take a brief at ease.
This evening, we have several items up. I'm going to go ahead and read through the order. We have eight bills on the agenda this late afternoon. We'll start with House Bill 80, Natural Gas Storage Tax Credits. House Bill 424, Geo Bond. It's our education bond package. House Bill 369, In-State Gas Pipeline. House Bill 50, Limit Overtime for Registered Nurses. House Bill 363, ADA membership. House Bill 345, naming a memorial bridge. House Bill 36, initiative contributions procedures. House Bill 190, children trust. And then we're going to have a presentation dealing with the retirement system, PERS and TERS. Removed from the agenda is House Bill 314, workers' compensation. And we are still not in receipt of House Bill 225, state procurement code. It's not in the committee as yet. So we're going to go ahead and start House Bill 280 by Representative Hawker regarding natural gas storage and tax credits. This is the second hearing on this bill. We first heard the bill on April 14th. The intent today is to entertain amendments, give members an opportunity to express their concerns, and look to the will of the committee. And I will move amendment number one and object for discussion and ask Mr. Peterson from my staff to come forward. We'll have an Eddie's. come back on the record. I misspoke on amendment number one. Senator Thomas.
I move amendment number one.
And I'll object for discussion. Senator Thomas.
Amendment number one extends the area of the state that is affected by the tax credits, qualified capital expenditures, to the state south of the 68th degree north latitude, and makes that change in several places in the changes the those few words in several places in the bill to identify that the credits are applied to the state south of the 68th degree north latitude, which is in fact south of Prudhoe Bay, south of the foothills. So it impacts very few explorers, but some of the smaller explorers that are doing work, particularly as those in our area of the state, as Doyon drilling for one, and others that may do some well drilling for oil and gas throughout the state, but south of Prudhoe Bay, which is the great concern that people have. And of course, as we look at the work done in Cook Inlet, we see some work popping up around the state, and want to make sure that in fact that same opportunity is provided across the state, other than at Prudhoe Bay, which obviously is a whole.
I'll go ahead and remove my objection to adoption of amendment number one. Any further objection to adoption of amendment number one? Seeing none, amendment number one is adopted. I'll go ahead and move amendment number two and object for discussion.
Mr. Chairman, Darwin Peterson, staff to Senator Stedman. The amendment number two, lines one and two, the deletion of the material from page 13, line 18 through page 14, line 30, are sections 16 and 17 of the bill. Those sections allow the taxpayer to apply the full amount of the credit for the qualified capital expenditure in one calendar year, as opposed to two calendar years, as is the current way that it's treated under statute. So with that change, the taxpayer would have to apply their credits over two calendar years. The date changes on line six of the amendment and line 10 of the amendment, those date changes change from December 31st, 2010 to June 30th, 2010, to when the credits can be applied in the Cook Inlet, and that's intended to encourage bringing online new gas as soon as possible. That's the extent of the changes in the amendment. The other two sections are just conforming changes to the two-year versus one-year tax credit.
I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of amendment number two. Any further objection to adoption of amendment number two? Seeing none, amendment number two is adopted. We're back to the main bill. We've got 4-0 fiscal notes in your packet from the Department of Natural Resources, Department of Commerce, Community Economic Development, and the Department of Administration and the House Finance Committee. And we've previously had public testimony. Do we have any further questions, concerns on this bill? Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out Senate CS for House Bill 280 as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral. Next up, House Bill 424 by the House Finance Committee regarding general obligation bonds. This is the second hearing on this bill. We first heard it on the 15th of April. The intent is to adopt a committee substitute, give members an opportunity to express their concerns and look to the will of the committee. Senator Hoffman may have a motion to adopt committee substitute version C.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt Senate CS for House Bill 242/C as a working document.
And I will object for explanation, and we'll have a brief at ease. I have Mr. Miles Baker from my staff come forward. Explain the CS, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Miles Baker, staff to Senator Stedman. The only change in the CS is, let's find the section. The original bill included the appropriation to the State Bond Committee of, just want to make sure I get the right bill, Mr. Chairman, sorry. Typically, in the GO bond bills we include, it is an appropriation bill, but we have included the money necessary for the State Bond Committee, which in the previous version of the bill was in Section 8, starting on page 3, 4,766,000 for the State Bond Committee to pay the expenses related to the sale and issuance of the bonds. And if you recall that the plan with this particular bond issuance, in order to take advantage of the federal rates that may be available, we're going to be exempting this issuance from AS 3715040 and authorize the Department of Revenue to use a negotiated sale for these bonds. So because we're doing that, the appropriation works a little bit differently than it typically would in a GO bond bill. So to just make sure we're doing that and accounting it into our closeout reports for how much has been appropriated this year, we've pulled that out of the bond bill. That's the only change, the appropriation to the State Bond Committee, and it was added to the capital budget that's on the House floor now, the exact same amount of money.
Do we have any questions on the adoption of the CS? Seeing none, I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of the CS. There is one fiscal note from the Department of Revenue for $10,000 in general funds for FY11 to cover the cost of public notice requirements, debt repayment again in FY12 at a cost of $29,769,600 in general funds. We previously had public testimony. Do we have any final comments, concerns on this bill? Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out Senate CS for House Bill 242 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Okay. We have a motion to move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral. We'll have a brief at ease. On record, next up, House Bill 369 by Representative Chenault regarding in-state gas pipeline. This is the second hearing on this bill. We first heard it the 15th of April. The intent today is to adopt a committee substitute, entertain amendments, and look to the will of the committee. Senator Hoffman, may I have a motion to adopt committee substitute version K?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt Senate CS for CS for House Bill 369 version K as a working document.
I'll object for explanation and ask Mr. Peterson to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Darwin Peterson, staff to Senator Stedman. The CS version K you have before you, run through the changes. First is on page 5, line 8. The previous version allowed the Alaska Railroad chairman of the board to appoint a designee to the team, the joint in-state gas development team being created in this legislation. The reference to the chair's designee has been deleted to make it very specific that we intend for the board chairman to be on the team, not a designee. On page 7, line 28, continuing on to page 8, line 7, is the in-state hire and job training language inserted at the request of Senator Thomas. It instructs the project developer to the extent allowed by law to hire Alaskans, contract with Alaskan businesses, and use job centers operated by the Department of Labor. Next change, Mr. Chairman, is on page 8, lines 12 and 13. This is new language regarding the confidentiality of proprietary information available to the joint in-state gas line development team. The previous language was very broad and caused concern among the industry that proprietary information not directly related to a gas pipeline would be available to the team. The new language specifically states that the team can only have access to information directly related to the planning, design, construction, or operation of the in-state natural gas pipeline. Next change is on page 9, section 5. This is a new section that would exempt NSTAR's Anchor Point Pipeline from the Right-of-Way Leasing Act, since it does not provide transportation services as defined in the Act, and it is an expansion of NSTAR's existing system and therefore exempt as it existed prior to 1972 when the Act was adopted. Next change is on page 11. In the transitional provisions, subsection 1 of the transitional provisions required the team to define the project parameters by February 15, 2011. Subsection 2 required that between November 15, 2010 and March 15, 2011, the team was required to seek letters of interest from private companies willing to develop the project. Those dates were removed. The responsibilities of the team haven't changed, but the dates were removed so as not to hamstring the team unnecessarily. Finally, section 11 in the previous version has been deleted. That section would have provided legislative authority for the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority to issue up to $250 million in bonds for the project. The deletion of this section required a title change, which is reflected on page 1, lines 10 and 11. That concludes the changes in the committee substitute, Mr. Chairman.
We have any questions on the CS? Seeing none, I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of the CS version K. We are back to the main document version K. Senator Thomas.
I move amendment number 1.
I'll object for explanation, Senator Thomas.
Amendment number 1 would add language regarding a project labor agreement to the project. And I know as we go forward, we're somewhat premature here, obviously, as we look at an open season for a big inch line and language in this particular document, this particular bill that creates a working team to a task force to put together, you know, the increments of what we need to do to create an in-state gas line. But we also need to make sure that even though I appreciate the language that was put in regarding Alaskan hire, I think it needs to go a step further, and that is project labor agreement, which is, as most of us are already aware, what that means is it puts into place a mechanism whereby you can actually guide resident hire and local hire and control it beyond the point of what is generally accepted by any stretch of the imagination that you can get beyond the 30 days and the intent to stay, and if you can vote in the state of Alaska, you actually are a resident. We ran into those problems time after time, and we run into those same problems at the military bases, which is somewhat surprising that we have people from even illegal immigrants working at Elmendorf Air Force Base, and we have a fairly large contingent of non-Alaskan workers that were brought to Fort Wainwright in Fairbanks on a big project there, and had both union and non-union contractors in meetings before the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee complaining about, you know, those types of situations taking place on the bases. So the project labor agreement is the only way that you can actually stretch the time frame for residents of the state of Alaska being hired on projects. It extends it 6 months to a year even, and depending on whose contract it is, and gives a great amount of opportunity for Alaskans to be trained and go to work on the project. So I suggested this as a potential to look at as we go forward with this task force, and think it makes a lot of sense. I realize it's a little difficult for some people to accept that principle, but thought it was a reasonable one in this case.
So, do you want to go forward with your amendment?
Well, I didn't know if anybody else had any comments
to make. Any questions or concerns, Senator Ellis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Senator Thomas bringing this before us. He's got the experience. He's an expert in this area of the ins and outs of local hire, Alaska hire, and project labor agreements. As we all know from experience, so I defer to his experience and wisdom on this. I think the committee should consider that as well. We all know that local hire and Alaska hire is a legally tricky area, and we've been disappointed and stymied by the courts in the past, and people aren't slow to sue us when they think that we've stepped over bounds. Project labor agreements are the only way really to achieve what most Alaskans would want us to achieve. And if we don't adopt this amendment, consider it seriously and adopt it, and a project like this were to move forward without this kind of provision, it's the kind of things, the kind of situation that Alaskans would live to regret. We would sit around, people would complain and be bitter for years to say, when we had this opportunity, and we appreciate the folks moving us forward with this legislation. Lots of hard work went into it. But this is the final piece that's necessary for Alaskans not to regret a major project moving forward. It also helps buy support for this concept and momentum, I think, to move forward. So it's the only real way to ensure that Alaskans get the jobs, that we don't see the kinds of importation of labor from overseas and elsewhere, and to, you know, nobody's going to sit around and say, I told you so, but if we move ahead without this kind of protection for Alaskan workers, we will live to regret it. And people will say for years, when they had the opportunity to protect Alaskans and Alaskan workers, they failed in what they should have done. So I appreciate this being before us. I feel strongly about it and hope the committee will adopt this amendment.
We have any other comments on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, the size of the amendment, and I'm kind of wondering what it does to the bill here at the lead hour. From what I know, we're probably going to have to go back to conference committee since it's a House bill coming on over here. Is that true?
Senator Olson, that depending on the changes, if they're, you know, if they're acceptable to the other body, and when they're unacceptable, then if they happen to be unacceptable, one option is to take any legislation to the conference committee.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand it's a late hour, and I understand it is a difficult situation for some people to understand, and I also realize some of the votes that have been taken on some of the other issues that we've discussed. So I appreciate the opportunity to put this forward, and I do hope that we will at least make sure that in our considerations with the task force, and I know some of those folks are here today, that be a serious consideration given to it. I do not want to cause this bill not to go forward, though, so I do understand and appreciate that concern. And with that, I would withdraw amendment number one.
Okay. Amendment number one was withdrawn. Any further amendments? We've got, seeing none, we've got two fiscal notes in your packet, one from the governor's office for $350,700 in general funds to cover the cost of hiring an in-state gas line coordinator and a project assistant, one from the Department of Revenue for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the amount of $15,640,600 in general funds. We previously had public testimony. Senator Hoffman.
We have an Eddie's.
Or brief Eddie's. On the record, we have passed out a new fiscal note, which matches the $15,640,600 in general funds. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out Senate CS for CS for House Bill 369 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached updated fiscal note. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee to the next committee referral. We'll have a brief at ease. We'll come back on the record. Next up, House Bill 50 by Representative Wilson regarding limiting overtime for registered nurses. This is the second hearing on this bill. We first heard it on April 17th. The intent today is to bring the bill back, address concerns committee members may have, look to the committee. Do we have any questions on this bill? We have 3-0 fiscal notes from the Department of Health and Social Services, one indeterminate fiscal note from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. We previously had public testimony. Seeing no further questions, Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out CS for House Bill 50 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll move the bill from committee to the next committee referral.
Mr. Chairman.
We'll have a brief at ease.
Just a quick comment. I was afraid.
Next up, House Bill 363 by the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee, regarding the aid of membership. This is the second hearing on this bill. We first heard it April 17th. The intent today is to bring the bill back so members can address any additional concerns and look to the will of the committee. There is one fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development for $22,808 receipts. We previously had public testimony. Do we have any questions or concerns on this bill? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and ask Senator Hoffman for a motion.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out CS for House Bill 363 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. We have objection. Seeing none, we'll move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral. Next up, House Bill 345 by Representative Rammers regarding the Sam Schlatter Memorial Bridge. This is the second hearing on this bridge. We first heard it April 17th. The intent today is to bring the bill back so members can address concerns they may have and look to the will of the committee. We have 1-0 fiscal note from the Department of Transportation because of the cost of the sign is budgeted in the construction of the bridge, and we previously had public testimony. Do we have any issues with this bridge or any questions? Bridge naming. Seeing none, Senator Hoffman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out House Bill 345 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
And we have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral. We'll have a brief at ease. Come back on the record. Next up, House Bill 36 by Representative Johansson regarding initiatives. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to hear from the bill sponsor, take public testimony, look to the will of the committee, and we have with us tonight representation from Representative Johansson's office. If she can come forward.
Good
can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill. And is this your first time or second time to?
First time, sir.
First time, that's what I thought. Well, welcome to Senate Finance.
For the record, my name is Sonia Christensen, staff to Representative Johansson. Would the committee prefer a section-by-section overview of the bill?
Yeah, or you could walk through the sponsor statement, whatever you want to do. We're flexible.
HB 36 is an attempt to bring more information to the public before elections. HB 36 has provisions in it that require early financial disclosure for ballot measure campaigns. What HB 36 does is it bumps the disclosure deadline back, so it requires financial disclosures throughout the signature gathering portion of ballot measure campaigns. Currently, there's no disclosure during that process. That means that up to a year can pass before any financial disclosures are required for ballot measure campaigns. HB 36 also requires public hearings in four judicial districts of the state, so two in each judicial district to be moderated by the Lieutenant Governor. This would bring the initiatives closer to the people and allow the people of Alaska to meet with the sponsors and also meet with the opposition and ask questions and voice their opinions. Another aspect of HB 36 is to require a legislative hearing. This would allow the affected state agencies to come in front of a standing committee of the legislature and discuss the ballot measure, if it were to be passed, discuss implementation issues with the ballot measure. HB 36 also requires signature gatherers to carry a full copy of the initiative. Currently, if the initiative is over 500 words, they're not required to carry a full copy with them. Those are pretty much the main points of HB 36, and I'm more than willing to walk through the sections if needed, and of course answer any questions of the committee.
We have any questions or concerns? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the administration in favor of these changes?
If we could, just a second, what the question was?
If the administration was in favor of these changes, and I had a follow-up question I'd like to have all answered also, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, go to that if you'd like. Representation from the administration come forward, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell, representing the administration. My office is responsible for initiatives in the state of Alaska from the administration perspective, and we support the initiative. Okay.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at initiatives and the process that's gone through over the last 10 years, it seems like the process is becoming more, I wouldn't say more cumbersome, but it becomes more involved. You've got to get out to different parts of the state, and now, like you say, if you're taking an initiative out, trying to get signatures, and if it's over 500 words, you have the option of not taking it. And if you don't, obviously this would do away with that. So if you have some of these initiatives that are fairly lengthy, you almost have to be carrying a book around. And so because of that, I was wondering if that was going to be, how inhibitory is not just that, but the whole HB 36 to the process.
And through the chair, this Lieutenant Governor Campbell to Senator Olson. Excellent question. That's, I believe, why the sponsor wants to bring this forward, is to help make it more transparent, to make sure that the citizens understand what the initiative is and those who are for it and those who are against it. And we support the public hearing process. We can do it. As you know, there's a zero fiscal note because I already travel around the state. We have state offices in all the jurisdictions. So this is an opportunity we believe would allow the citizens of Alaska to have more understanding of what they're going to vote and when they vote on it. And the more complex it gets, the more they need to really have the vetting of that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Thomas, any questions for the bill sponsor?
I believe so. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The concept of not allowing the use of per signature commission, is there a specific reason for not allowing people to be paid for soliciting signatures on the...
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, that provision was actually removed from this bill on the floor, on the House floor, and so that provision is no longer applicable to...
Oh, okay. I was reading the House sponsor statement anyhow, so okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for the bill sponsor or the Lieutenant Governor while he's so handy? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Pebble Initiative, how would these provisions, what would some of the implications have been from the challenges we had with the process with the Pebble Initiative?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, this HB, the provisions in HB 36 would have required disclosure earlier in the process. Technically, right now, if no money transfers from the signature gathering phase to the campaign phase, basically after a ballot measure is certified for the ballot, if there's no transfer of money there, there's absolutely no disclosure. So what this would have done was been able to allow the public to see who's funding the signature gathering phase, which is an essential part of the initiative.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions for the bill sponsor, Lieutenant Governor? We have, thank you. We've got 1-0 fiscal note from the Department of Administration for $60,200 in general funds for one permanent full-time position. There are 2-0 fiscal notes from the office, the governor's office, on behalf of the Lieutenant Governor's office and the Division of Elections. We have nobody signed up in the LIOs, nobody signed up offline, and no one signed up in the room to testify. So if we have any final questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, Senator Hoffman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out Senate CS for CS for SS House Bill 36 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee. The next committee referral. Next up, House Bill 190 by Representative Fairclough regarding the Children's Trust. This is the second hearing on this bill. We first heard it April 16th. The intent today is to bring the bill back so members can address any concerns they may have and look to the will of the committee. Do we have any questions concerning this bill? We've got 3-0 fiscal notes from the Department of Health and Social Services and the Department of Revenue and the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and we have previously had public testimony. Any questions or concerns? Seeing none, Senator Hoffman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out CS for House Bill 190 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
And we have a motion to move the bill from committee to the next committee referral. Attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations. We have objection. Seeing none, we'll move the bill from committee to the next committee referral. Next up, a presentation on the retirement system of the state or an update from the administration. We can have representation come forward from the administration. Mr. Brooks. We will start by having both you fellows, even though you've been here numerous times, introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then we're not taking public testimony today, just a presentation from the Department of Administration. So I'll let you guys decide how you want to do the presentation between the two of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kevin Brooks.
Mike in.
My name is Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration. I'm joined today with...
I'm Jerry Burnett. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Treasury at the Department of Revenue.
And also with us at the hearing today is Pat Shire, our Director of Retirement Benefits, as we get into a discussion. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to start out with a general discussion on a little bit of a timeline. You should have some documents in your packet. Then I would turn it over to Mr. Burnett to talk about the returns on the pension funds, and then we'd get into maybe a little bit of a deeper discussion on the unfunded liability, and then lastly, impact of the defined contribution plan on recruitment and retention efforts with the public employers.
Thank you.
Just starting out, the top sheet in your handouts is just a brief timeline, basically since 2000, and I won't go through that in great detail, but I just wanted to call attention to the committee on the kind of the history of the unfunded liability in the last 10 years or so. and how that has changed. Some of the more significant impacts were in 2002 when Mercer changed several of their actuarial assumptions after an audit by a separate actuarial firm, Milliman. So we had a unfunded liability that was in the hundreds of millions of dollars in 2001 that went to in excess of $4 billion combined for both the PERS and TERS programs. And that continued to on a general trend upward throughout the 2000s. And the most recent valuation that we have is 2008. As of June 30, 2008, that unfunded liability was at $7.5 billion combined. And that was nearly $2.7 billion for TERS, $4.8 billion for PERS. Now, we know since that time there's been significant losses in the market, and Mr. Burnett can talk about those, during 2008 with some rebound during 2009. So it certainly is a dynamic picture, but it's one where the last released statements reflect that actuarial unfunded liability at $7.5 billion. As you know, we had just the other highlights that have occurred since then. We had passage of SB 141 that set up the hybrid DCR plan. We had passage of SB 125 in 2008 that set up the cost share program and set the PERS contribution caps at 22% and the TERS contribution cap at 12.56. Since that time, as you know, Mr. Chairman, the state is picking up and making deposits to the PERS and TERS funds on all on the actuarial determined calculation that's in excess of 22 for PERS and 12.56 for TERS. So with that brief overview on the timeline, I could stop and take any questions, or I would ask Mr. Burnett to talk about the next page of your handout, which will give you some idea of what returns the state's been experiencing on the funds.
Go ahead and continue.
Okay, this is Jerry Burnett. This is a chart that's in your graph that you have. If you look at that, just shows PERS, but PERS and TERS have almost exactly the same returns. You can see the line in the center of that graph is the actuarially expected return at 8.25%, and the lines around it are the actual returns. You see 2008, it dipped down quite a bit. 2009, it came back. This goes to the end of December 2009. As of February 28th, 2010, PERS had a total asset value, cash asset value, not the actuarial asset value, of $9,554,000,000, and TERS had an asset value of $4,167,000,000. 2009 calendar year earned 13.28% on PERS and TERS. For the past 5 years, the returns were 3.19%. For the past 7 years, the returns were 6.65%, and for the past 18 and a quarter years, which is your chart, the returns were 7.33%. And that's a little bit below the line, and you can see on the graph very clearly where that leaves us. And I can answer any questions about that, about our asset allocation, or where we are on that.
And then the current use in these current numbers as of end of June, even though it's several months back now, you know.
Right.
What was the liability spread marked to market at the end of June?
End of June, that would be on our draft.
Mr. Chairman, we have the draft report for the June 30, 2009 valuation, which is going to be released to the ARM board in the next couple weeks. But from that draft, I think I wrote those numbers down, if you can bear with me a second. We're looking at the unfunded liability for TERS at $3,370,000,000, and for PERS at $6,330,000,000, for a total of $9.7 billion. And then, as we stated, then there's been some rebound in the market during the last calendar year, but certainly not to the extent that we experienced losses during 2008. Moving on, Mr. Chairman, there's a handful of slides that I wanted to, if you can indulge us, I don't want to spend a few minutes on. This is information that our actuary, Buck Consultants, put together. And we were looking at three different scenarios, what they've called us.
Fetties. For the interruption, folks. Go ahead and continue.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. So as I was saying, we had asked the state's actuary, Buck Consultants, to run some scenarios for us on what the state could expect to pay, both as a payroll assessment, which is the 22% and 12% that we talked about for PERS and TERS respectively, as well as that additional on behalf of amount. And In the broader presentation, they had provided us with a slow, modest, and strong scenario. The charts in your packet today are just what they considered the slow at 8.25 returns. And you know, some would argue that 8.25 is not necessarily a slow scenario at all. But by comparison to the three that they ran for us, it's really in that context. So the charts that you'll see, we have two each for PERS and TERS, and they reflect what the cost is to the state, both as a percentage and then in dollars. And so the first chart is a PERS contribution rates, and if you'll see, it takes a 30-year horizon there, and the yellow bars at the top of that chart on the first page there reflect those appropriations that are required in excess of 22% for PERS, and you can see that it's a dramatic amount. The actuarial determined rates rise to over 40% by 2016, and stay above there through 2029. So that's the scenario that we're looking at, and those are the contributions that one will be making through payroll, and two as additional appropriations on behalf of other public employers on the PERS side. Now the next page will show that same representation in dollars, and it's just to give you the same information in two ways, one as a percent and one as the dollars. Again, the yellow portion represents the amount that the state will be required to include in appropriation bills for on behalf of payments for public employers. Moving on then, in the third slide is the same representation for the TERS program. And you can see that the yellow, again, is quite large. Now, in TERS, we've set that employer rate at 12.56%. So this represents the amount above 12.56 that the state will be making on behalf of school districts and other public employers that employ members of the TERS retirement system. And you can see that there on this graph that the actuarially determined rates climbed to over 60% by 2015, or 2016, I'm sorry, and stay up at that level through 2029. And then the next chart, again, like in the PERS example, shows the dollars that would be involved with those rates. And so we're looking at significant, a requirement for significant appropriations to the PERS and TERS funds to pay down this unfunded liability that we've spoken to you about earlier in the presentation.
Could you help us with the acronyms on the bottom?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, at the bottom of the chart, you see DCR, ER contributions. That's defined contribution, retirement system, employer contribution. State assistance is represented by the yellow bars. DB, ER contributions is defined benefit. Employer contributions on DCR pay. And then we have defined benefit, employer contributions on defined benefit pay.
So then these are going to be in the upcoming report by Buck, and they're to be released in a few weeks, is that correct, because it's a draft?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, these were done last fall. They're not part of the draft actuary's report, the valuation that's due out, but it will be consistent with material that will be released in that report.
And then when does the next actuarial check Bucks, because every, I can't remember, is it every 2 years we have a check or three?
Actually,
Mr. Chairman, if I may, for the record, Pat Shire, Director, Division of Retirement and Benefits. Aon Consulting conducted a thorough replication of the actuarial valuation last year, so we wouldn't expect to see one for another 3 years.
Right. Okay, it's every 3 years.
Every four total.
Every four,
as
every
I understand
4 years.
It. Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, I may be off on that, but that's my current understanding without looking at the law.
Can you go ahead and continue?
Mr. Chairman, in addition to that, I think you also know that we have a second actuary review the work of Buck Consultants, and that's done annually, and that's occurring now before the report is released to the ARM board. So we have that check going on an annual basis, and then the thorough comprehensive one that occurs on a 4 or 5 year cycle. We can get back to you with the exact timing of that. So that's the third piece of our presentation. The last one we wanted to talk to you about was an analysis of employees that have been hired both in the DB plan and in the DC plan, the defined benefit, defined contribution plan, and kind of their retention over the years. And so I'll turn that back over to Mr. Shire to talk to you about that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, comparison that we have is made even more useful, I think, by calculating percentages out in the column. But you can see when individuals were hired in FY 2003 for the DB plan at the very top, that we have out at the end, if you calculate that, is still active. About 40% of those people for the DB plan are still active. If we were to look at a more comparative list, we might go 3 years away from 2009 and 2007. And of 2177 hired in 2007 for the DB plan, 63% are still active, compared to 3,563 hired in the DCR plan, 57% are still active. And you can see that the longer you go on, the more people leave, both defined benefit workers and presumably after time will show that the defined contribution. We really can't know what the reasons are for that, but we have shown simply the numbers here. We'd answer any questions.
Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Mr. Shire, I had assumed that someone conducted separation interviews or surveys and that you can compile that information for the legislature to think about whether this was a good policy or where we are with that. Are you saying we really don't know why people leave if they're dissatisfied with the current defined contribution, or we just are open to speculation? How does that work? I had assumed separation interviews or surveys, something was kept track of in that regard.
I'll defer to
Through the chair and Senator Ellis, we have heard anecdotal information that, you know, we've heard that people are leaving because of the retirement system. We've heard that people leave because they're not paid enough. You know, our approach has been that we need to have a comprehensive compensation package that is competitive with wages and as well as providing a well-rounded benefit package. What we can't really tell you from the several years that we've had since the passage of the defined contribution plan is that the numbers are not significantly different as far as retention of members who were in a DB plan versus a DC plan. Now, a person will fully vest in the employer's contribution on the DCR plan after 5 years, and there's some thought that at 5 years someone could just say, well, that's the clock, the clock's been ticking for me, and I'm going to take both sides of the contributions, employee, employer, and take that and go somewhere else. And that is one of the features of the plan. It's a portable plan, and someone could go to another employer and roll that in. But right now, the data we have on hires, we don't do separation interviews in a real standardized way to say, I mean, not every employee is interviewed on their way out the door and asked for the reasons for their departure. But overall, the numbers are not significantly different between DB or DC employees leaving the state.
I think later on will be next year, it'd be nice to have, we'll have 2010 in there, and it'd be nice to have this table put in percentages and some charts. So as we take a look at this, because we want to model that and track that type of data and make it easier also for the committee to pick up trends and stuff. Have any other questions for the Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you guys for your presentation. What is the balance of the PERS and the TERS fund as of today?
As of today?
Well, how about if you can give
yesterday,
us
yesterday, last month?
FY, if you can give us,
yeah.
If you know the end of December.
Fiscal year, whatever.
Well, I did earlier when I was talking, I gave it for as of February 28th. 2010.
That's fine. Any number.
PERS was $9,554,496,000, and TERS was $4,167,254,000. Now, those are not going to be numbers that are exactly the same as what you'd see later on, because we have real estate valuations and some other illiquid assets that the valuations are lagged by some period of time. But that's as close as we could get on that date.
So, Mr. Burnett, if you had to throw a dart at the wall behind me and guess the liability as of January or March or whatever, with TERS and PERS, give us a range of what your gut feeling is, where we're at with the market increases we've had.
Well, I think our draft valuation is looking at a $9.7 billion unfunded liability. Given what I've seen in the market, we're probably maybe a couple hundred million dollars less than that if you had actual asset values. Well, I can't, they're using actuarial values. It's probably very similar to that, because a smoothed actuarial value for the draft report as of last year, which would represent a higher value than the actual value at the end of last fiscal year. And with the 13%, with the returns that we've incurred, we're probably getting close to where the smooth number is.
So it's basically a $9.5 billion hole.
Right, $9.5 to $10 billion range.
Yeah. We're going to get that turned around and close the gap. Senator Ellis.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to go back to the information issue. If separation interviews aren't done on a sampling of folks leaving state service, don't you give them a brief survey on the way out to fill out so you guys would know what's going on with your workforce? Doesn't that seem like a reasonable and cost-effective way to gain some information. I can understand why a separation interview, which many major employers do to have good information to make policy and in the future, but if you're not going to do that, wouldn't just a simple online survey be a smart thing to do?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, yes, I believe it would, and I think there's some of that going on. What I'd like to do is check with our Division of Personnel and Labor Relations and see just what is that outreach that's happening with hiring managers as they have turnover with the staff, and I could certainly report that back. But I would agree with you that it's a reasonable thing to do, and I think there's some of that going on right now.
Thank you, and if I can continue, Mr. Chairman, what is the status in our lawsuit against Mercer, the people that gave us such horrible advice in the past? Are we winning? Are we gaining? Are we delayed in court? What's the latest?
To the chair, to Senator Ellis, that lawsuit is scheduled for a court date in Juneau, Alaska later this year, I believe. And beyond that, I really couldn't tell you. The attorney, I've had confidential briefings on it, but I can't tell you where we are on it, that it is scheduled with a court date in Juneau.
Thank you.
I think on that issue, it's a big issue watched nationwide, mm-hmm. and to have that magnitude of a trial in Juneau is going to have a lot of attention and be in a lot of press. So
I would hope so.
I hope that the state prevails in their endeavor. There was a question on this side of the table. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to make sure I understand, your last table, if I'm understanding it correctly, you're taking, on the very top row, you're taking people hired in 2003 for a total of 268 folks, and then following those particular folks through to 2009. Is that correct?
That's through the chair. That's correct, Senator Thomas.
And that was with the defined benefit plan, and then you took the defined contribution plan hires starting in 2007 and ran them forward the next couple of years and followed those same folks just to see what they're doing, even though obviously during that time frame more people were being hired, but you were following specific individuals. In the case of the defined contribution, you were following those 3,563 people that reduced to 2,200 and then to 2,000. Is that correct?
Again, through the chair, that's correct, Senator Thomas. So and these are all PERS and all PERS employers, PERS and TERS employers are listed on this. So the state is the largest PERS employer, certainly, but there's municipalities and other political subdivisions throughout the state that this reflects a compilation of all PERS employers, just to be clear.
And just one other minor thing. I see that in 2002 it says on the front page that Mercer changes several actuarial assumptions after Milliman's audit. And then 3.5 years later, thereabouts, Buck Consultants replaces Mercer as the state's actuary. Was there a reason that, other than I realize at that point in time we were suffering, as it says initially, a bear market, but with an audit and somebody then changing their actuarial assumptions, that they were left in place for 3.5 years?
Through the chair and Senator Thomas, the fact that there was an audit in 2002 is not unusual. I mean, we have the same as occurring now, and those are the checks and balances that have been put in place. So it's not uncommon for a second actuarial firm to come along and audit the first actuary's work. The changes that they made were significant, and at that time, I don't think any of us sitting at the table were involved in our current roles at that time, but my understanding is that there was quite a bit of concern with Mercer, and that grew over the years, but we had a contract with them, and ultimately we ended up not renewing or severing that contract and hiring a new actuary. But as far as what occurred during that period of time between July of 2002 and November of 2005, when Buck was hired as a result of an RFP, I would have to look into that and get back to you. But
follow up?
Yeah. You don't have to get back with me. I'm just curious if we have a different arrangement with our current consultants that would have a shorter time frame on it so that we would not be precluded from getting rid of somebody that is audited and has to make dramatic actuarial assumption changes. I can't even imagine what they would be, although I'm familiar what some are, but I can't imagine what several actuarial assumptions would be, and that goes forward in that 3.5 year period, and we are down a $2.25 billion or more.
Through the chair and Senator Thomas, in fact, with the passage of SB 141, that is in fact where many of these checks and balances came in, if you will. Through that pension reform, we have an annual review every 4 or 5 years. We have a comprehensive audit that Mr. Shire referred to earlier, and so it really was the experience with Mercer and that you're referring to that resulted in the pension reform of SB 141 that institute or implemented a number of safeguards to ensure that, you know, there's more timely reaction to things that are occurring with these funds.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. We're going to stand at ease with the call of the chair.